Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Today we'll look at alternative journalism, covering important current events the corporate media either lie about or else decide not to report at all. We'll focus on one important story that the corporate press dropped down the memory hole, a riot in Miami in 2003. We'll look at Jeremy Scahill's good reporting on the incident in the alternative press. Then we'll hear a talk by Scahill on more recent sins of the media concerning the Iraq War. I hope you'll be able to stay tuned. Since I began these broadcasts a bit more than a year ago, I've been listening to more music than before, looking for good songs to play on the show, something relevant to the topics we cover. That's been neat. I've discovered some artists I hadn't heard before. I rediscovered my old friend Ann Feeney, and I discovered about 100 additional songs by David Rovix. I've learned some history, too, because of Rovix. One of his songs is a narrative titled Battle of Blair Mountain. What the heck was that? Sounds like a skirmish between the cavalry and the Indians. No, but it was a real live ammo battle between many oppressed miners struggling to form a union and the forces of law, order, private property, maximum profits, and oppression of the workers. Yes, the mine owners' goons had a grand old party out on the mountain. This wasn't back in Indian fighting days, but in the 20th century, in West Virginia in 1921. You've known people who were alive at the time. To make a long story short, 10,000 angry and armed miners had a shootout with a smaller but better organized and better armed gang of sheriff's men, state militia, mercenaries, Methodists, and the sort of thug who loves enforcing law and order on their fellow proletarians. Eventually, law and property rights prevailed. The union was broken in the region, and the mines of Logan and Mingo counties continued to cut miners' wages. The gun battle gained international press coverage at the time. Today, it's practically unknown. Somebody decided you don't need to know about it. We don't want to teach working-class Americans their history. They might get ideas. Anyway, I don't want to talk about Mingo County, but instead about Miami, topic of yet another David Rovix song. Here was yet another battle I had never heard of. In 2003, there was a big riot in Miami in November. You didn't hear about it because the rioters were not poor people of color, but uniformed police officers, wearing Ninja Warrior shock troop uniforms, to be sure, but uniformed. They busted the heads of peaceful demonstrators who were drawing attention to a planning session of international free trade bigwigs in Miami. That was the ministerial meeting of the Free Trade Area of the Americas. You didn't hear about the riot because the local news media gave it little coverage and mainly quoted official lies about the great restraint police showed when they were attacked by violent anarchist protesters. You didn't hear about it because the national corporate media seldom finds popular protest against the ruling elite newsworthy, unless they can show corpses or smashed store windows or an injured cop. Alas, none of these was available, and smashed peaceful protesters don't count. You didn't hear about it unless you read about it in the alternative press or heard of it in the alternative media, which you're doing even as we speak, or heard about it in alternative music found on the internet or played on alternative radio. Here's alternative music maker David Rovix, who was there when it happened.
Leaders of the world had gathered to make the planet freer for free trade, to create a better business climate for all the profits they had made. Surrounded by an army, there for their defense, armed with APCs and copters and lots of common sense, behind a fence, behind a wall that shouts, "You shall not pass." Broken skulls, plastic bullets, and 1,000 gallons of tear gas. And the world leaders kept on talking behind the moat upon the hill, and they boasted of prosperity in their latest free trade bill. They thank God, they thank Boeing, they thank the World Bank, they thank the firepower of the M1 tank. They defended their positions and the glory of their class with broken skulls, plastic bullets, and 1,000 gallons of tear gas. On the streets we chanted, "We have no clubs or guns, we've just come to tell the people the evil ways this system runs. But the truth can set us free, the rulers all knew well, so they drowned the truth with copters and the ringing of the bell, with their tasers on our bodies and our faces in the grass. Broken skulls, plastic bullets, and 1,000 gallons of tear gas." Cameras hid behind the lines, 500,000 men in blue. When the rich men moved their lips, they recorded them on cue. The occupation of a city by an army of police wasn't worthy of a mention from the reporters of the peace. Neither were the wounded children or the boarded glass or the broken skulls, plastic bullets, and 1,000 gallons of tear gas.
By conventional standards, Jeremy Scahill is a first-rate investigative journalist. He's the co-recipient of the Polk Award in 1998 with Amy Goodman for their radio documentary Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. For years, he's been a correspondent for the alternative TV and radio news program Democracy Now! And a frequent contributor to The Nation magazine. He won another Polk Award for his highly acclaimed recent book, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. In 2003, he covered the Miami protests for Democracy Now!, but I think his best reporting on the subject is a long article he published online in Counterpunch. I've condensed it for radio. Paramilitaries, embedded journalists, and illegal protests. Think this is Iraq? It's Miami, by Jeremy Scahill. Dateline Miami. We watched Police Chief John Timoney the night before on the local news, praising his men for the restraint they had shown in the face of violent anarchists intent on destroying the city. In reality, the tens of thousands who gathered outside the ministerial meeting of the Free Trade Area of the Americas Summit were peacefully demonstrating. What they encountered was nothing short of a police riot. On the news, Chief Timoney spoke in sober tones about the tear gas that demonstrators fired at his officers. That's right, Timoney said the protesters were the ones launching the tear gas. The next day, as we were packing to leave, we were stopped by police on bikes, including Chief Timoney. One of the bicyclists approached us with a notepad. "Can I have your names?" he asked. I thought he was a police officer preparing a report. He had on a Miami Police polo shirt, just like Timoney's. He had a Miami Police bike helmet, just like Timoney's. He had a bike, just like Timoney's. In fact, there was only one small detail that separated him from Timoney, a small badge around his neck, identifying him as a reporter with the Miami Herald. That reporter was one of dozens who were embedded with the Miami forces. It's hard to call them police. The Miami forces deployed to protect the FTAA ministerial meetings from thousands of unarmed protesters. So dangerous was the protest, apparently, that the overwhelming majority of the images on TV were from helicopter shots, where very little could be seen, except that there was a confrontation between police and the protesters. This gave cover for Timoney and other officials to make outrageous and false statements over and over. Timoney spun his tales of hardcore anarchists rampaging through the streets of Miami. Outsiders coming to terrorize and vandalize our city, quote unquote. He painted a picture of friendly, restrained police enduring constant attacks from rocks, paint, gas canisters, smoke bombs, and fruit. After last week, no one should call what Timoney runs in Miami a police force. It's a paramilitary group. Thousands of soldiers dressed in khaki uniforms with full black body armor and gas masks marched in uniform through the streets, banging batons against their shields, chanting, "Back! Back! Back!" There were armored personnel carriers and helicopters. The forces fired indiscriminately into crowds of unarmed protesters. Scores of people were hit with skin-piercing rubber bullets. Thousands were gassed with an array of chemicals. On several occasions, police fired loud concussion grenades into the crowds. Police shocked people with electric tasers. Demonstrators were shot in the back as they retreated. One young guy's apparent crime was holding his fingers in a peace sign in front of the troops. They shot him multiple times, including once in the stomach at point-blank range. After receiving $8.5 million in federal funds from the $87 billion Iraq spending bill, Miami needed to have a major combat operation. It didn't matter if it was warranted. As soon as the union demonstrators began to disperse, the police escalated the violence against other protesters. Timoney's forces ordered the protesters to clear the area in front of the Intercontinental Hotel. Some of the demonstrators shouted back that they had a right to peacefully protest the FTAA. Boom! The concussion grenades started flying. Hiss! The tear gas was sprayed. Rat-a-tat-tat! The rubber bullets were fired. Bam! Bam! The batons were swinging. The police methodically marched in a long column directly at the several hundred. They fired indiscriminately at the crowds. One woman had part of her ear blown off. Another was shot in the forehead. I got shot twice, once in the back and another time in the leg. My colleague, John Hamilton, from the Workers' Independent News Service, was shot in the neck by a pepper spray pellet, a small ball that explodes into a stinging white powder. Eventually, the police forced the dissipating group of protesters into one of the poorest sections of Miami, surrounding them on four sides. They fired gas and rubber bullets at us as they moved in. All of us realized we had nothing to do but run. We scattered down side streets and alleys, ducking as we fled. Eventually, we made it out. The next day, we went to a midday rally outside the Dade County Jail. It was a peaceful assembly of about 300 people. The numbers of fully armed troops grew and grew, and they moved in from all four sides. They announced that people had 3 minutes to disperse from this, quote, unlawful assembly, unquote. The protesters complied. The police then attacked the dispersing crowd, chasing about 30 people into a corner. They shoved them to the ground and beat them. They gassed them at close range. My colleague from Democracy Now, Anna Nogueira, and I got separated in the mayhem. Anna was wearing her press credentials in plain sight as she videotaped the action. As the police began handcuffing people, Anna told them that she was a journalist. One of the officers says, "She's not with us, she's not with us," meaning that although Anna was clearly a journalist, she was not embedded with the police and therefore should be arrested. In custody, the authorities made Anna strip naked in front of male officers. She was held in a cockroach-filled jail cell until 3:30 a.m. Other independent journalists remained locked up for much longer and faced serious charges, some of them felonies. In the end, Anna was charged with failure to disperse. The real crime seems to be failure to embed. In the times in which we live, this is what democracy looks like. Thousands of soldiers, calling themselves police, deployed in U.S. cities to protect the power brokers from the masses. And damned be the journalist who dares to say it, or film it, like it is. This is New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust, and I'm glad to find you still with us. We heard my reading of Jeremy Scahill's fine reporting of news you could find only in the alternative media. Coming up is part of a recent talk by Scahill in which he discusses some other stories that the corporate media continues to suppress. Large-scale popular opposition to our rulers' Iraq adventure. And the decade-long war the United States waged against the people of Iraq under Clinton between the two official Gulf Wars. Scahill's a low-key, highly personal storyteller that I think you'll like. The story starts when CNN selects him as an expert on Blackwater, not realizing what they're getting into.
So he says CNN's calling you, and I'm like, what are you, I thought it was like, I'm like, it's not April 1st, it's not my birthday, it was, what's the joke here? And he's like, no, did you hear what happened? And what had happened was something deadly serious, and that is that Blackwater mercenary forces in Baghdad had opened fire on a crowded intersection of Iraqis, and at that time we didn't know how many Iraqis were killed, but it was unfolding as the single deadliest massacre carried out in Iraq at the hands of private forces from Blackwater. And so I called CNN back and they said, we want to have you on live at the top of the hour at noon on a broadcast that will be simultaneously on CNN and on CNN International. So, you know, I found the one suit that I have, which I had bought in Amman, Jordan, on a trip into Iraq for $5. It was a used suit. And what was apparent to me from like the lead into it is that whoever made the mistake of calling me that morning didn't really know who I was. They just Googled Blackwater and saw, oh, there's this guy who wrote a book on Blackwater. Get him in here. So they secretly I make it onto CNN. So here I am sitting in this chair, you know, the expert on Blackwater and I'm sitting there and they start by saying, you know, what is Blackwater? So I start to describe Blackwater and I'm talking about the connections to the Bush administration and the radical right-wing evangelical Christian that runs the company and the fact that what we just saw unfold in Baghdad is not an isolated incident, but this is the latest in a pattern of extrajudicial killings of Iraqis. And the interviewer sort of stops for a moment and he, clearly I wasn't saying what I was supposed to say. And he said, well, you sound like you're very critical of these companies. You know, journalists aren't supposed to be critical. They're just supposed to tell you the facts, right? So he I said, well, yes, and I kept talking. And then he said, well, what would your alternative be? Now, what he meant to say is, you know, what would your alternative be? Meaning, shouldn't the U.S. military be doing this job? But I, in classic, well, independent media fashion, decided to answer the question that I thought he should have asked, which is, what's the alternative to Blackwater being in Iraq? And I said, well, the alternative is immediate withdrawal of all U.S. forces from Iraq, including mercenary forces. You don't say that on CNN. And I think that the host of the show was like a deer in the headlights moment and he didn't quite know what to do with it. In fact, if you watch the video clip, he's sort of smirking nervously and waiting for someone to save him or something. And I decided to just, you know, carry on, keep going. And so I said, and I think that the United States should pay reparations to the Iraqi people for the damage that we brought on that country. And he still wasn't saying anything. So I said, and you know, let me just say this. I think it shows the arrogance of U.S. foreign policy to say that we're going to dictate a future or a form of government to a people that invented the written word. The arrogance of the United States. And with that, the interview was done. You know, so I figured, you know, I'm done. The mistake was there. The cat's out of the bag. I was getting calls from people I hadn't talked to for years. And, you know, aren't you afraid for doing something like that on CNN? Like, what do you think's going to happen? That, like, Anderson Cooper and Wolf Blitzer are going to abduct me and send me to Media Guantanamo or something? So I finished with CNN. But then it's bizarre. It sort of continued. I ended up one night on ABC, NBC, and CBS on all three network newscasts in the same night. And I was on the News Hour with Jim Lehrer, where I debated the top lobbyist for the mercenary industry. And now, did you know the mercenary industry has a lobbying organization, and its name is the International Peace Operations Association? I wish it was a joke. It's just like the most Orwellian, you know, name for an organization of mercenaries. And I'm on the News Hour with Jim Lehrer. And it got so bad for them that they just stopped at a point providing people to debate me. And now it's not because I'm some extraordinary, brilliant person or something. It's because for the first time in I think a long time, someone who actually legitimately was against the war and was able to articulate a view held by millions of people in this country was actually allowed to be in these discussions. And I took that deadly serious. I talked to many of my colleagues and my friends and people I looked up to because I all of a sudden was being invited because I happened to be an expert. They all love their experts. I was a technical expert on something, but then I was using the opportunity to also inject something that has been systematically censored. And that is what Amy Goodman says, the viewpoint of the silenced majority in this country. And so for a month, we were able, and I say we because many people helped in this, we were able to bring anti-war analysis onto the corporate media networks. And God bless Bill Moyers. He dedicated an entire hour on his program on PBS and really dissected the foundation of the company Blackwater, the extent of its operations, the use of these companies on U.S. soil. Now, lest you think that I somehow have become some kind of corporate media guy who gets called, you know, every other week, you won't see me anymore on these shows, but it sort of wasn't always that way. So I don't even have a college degree, and I was talking to people in classes today about, well... Yeah, I have the rare distinction of being the first generation not to go to college in my family. It's like, my brother's a lawyer, my sister has a master's degree, my dad has two. It's like, you know, and then there's me. I finished 2.5 years of college. This voice of this journalist talking about the Republican Revolution, and then also the next day confronting Bill Clinton's press secretary, and it was, of course, Amy Goodman. And this was before Democracy Now! Had gone in the air. And it was the first time that alternative, and I don't like that phrase, but alternative media really entered my landscape, that I'd ever heard of this. And I became a passionate listener of Democracy Now!, an active listener. It was my greatest source of information and inspiration in many ways. I couldn't believe something like this existed. And it was like a moment, and I was telling the students this today, where you open this, it's like Alice in Wonderland, you open this tiny door and you peek in, and there's a huge universe in there that you had no idea ever existed. That the whole point of journalism, in the broadest sense, should be to take information and put it into a form that's accessible to people and that's going to mean something to their lives. Politically, what journalism should be is that you give voice to the voiceless and you hold those in power accountable. And in the process, you try to paint a picture that the person who hears your report or reads your report or watches your report, you're painting a situation or introducing them to the people that they may never meet. But you want them to feel as though they know them as human beings, particularly in the case of people who are victims of wars that emanate from the shores of the United States of America. That's our role and our responsibility as journalists. That was what I learned through the process of being around people that believed that. It was a way of life to them. And out of Nigeria, then I scrounged up money and I ended up going to Iraq in 1997 with... the great human rights activist Kathy Kelly and Voices in the Wilderness, and went with them on a humanitarian delegation. And what I saw in the hospitals of Iraq in the 1990s when Bill Clinton was president would forever change the way that I viewed the world and viewed my own country. Because the United States was waging an undeclared war against Iraq in the 1990s that doesn't exist in most history books because it was almost uncovered in the corporate media. But the United States waged for the entire duration of Bill Clinton's presidency in the 1990s an economic war against the civilian population of Iraq, where they essentially blockaded the country and made it so that they couldn't import basic medical supplies and foodstuffs and other humanitarian supplies as punishment for Saddam Hussein remaining the leader of Iraq. They collectively punished the people of Iraq. And that, combined with the fact that in the 1991 Gulf War, the United States had destroyed the civilian infrastructure of Iraq, bombed water treatment facilities, and polluted the environment, meant that hospitals throughout Iraq had a deadly cocktail of contamination of their environment, which caused skyrocketing rates of cancer, and then they didn't have the medical supplies to treat the diseases that they were facing, the illnesses that they were facing. Almost always when I was in Iraq, the place that I spent time more often in than not were the hospitals of Iraq. And they were like death rows for infants, where you would have doctors that would say to you, I'm a doctor and I have my medical degree from Oxford. I have a patient here who has this ailment. The difference between my patient and myself is that I have a white coat and I know what I could do if I had the tools to address this medical situation, but I can't because I don't have those medical tools. And so you saw children dying. You saw kids born with congenital malformations that didn't exist in modern medical journals. You saw mothers wailing when their ultrasound determined that they had a child inside of their womb, a baby inside of their womb that was going to be born without a brain because the father was a veteran of the Iraqi military exposed to U.S. depleted uranium munitions in the south of Iraq. Now, some of this, for some of you who may not have studied that history or are younger, it may sound like I'm talking about, you know, ancient history. This just happened a decade ago. That was U.S. policy. And the people that implemented that policy are now once again in power because Barack Obama has rehired all of these people to run U.S. foreign policy. The correct term for a group of hawks is a kettle of hawks. Obama has hired a kettle of hawks to run U.S. foreign policy. People whose records we know well, whose histories we know well, who are not unproven characters, we know who they are, and they have been wrong about so much for so long. Barack Obama campaigned on a pledge to not only end the war, but to end the mindset that got us into war. And his campaign said that on the premier foreign policy issue of our generation, John McCain and George Bush were wrong, and I was right. And Obama said it repeatedly, and Biden said it repeatedly, and Greg Craig said it repeatedly, and the campaign put out press releases that said this. Why then, President-elect Obama, have you hired a team of people who agreed with George Bush and John McCain and disagreed with the 130 members of the House of Representatives that voted against the war, the 23 senators that voted against the war? There is not a single person who was a true opponent of that war that has been tapped for a senior position in the foreign policy apparatus of Barack Obama's administration.
And that, brothers and sisters, is what is technically known as change we can believe in, we being the ExxonMobil Board of Directors. And on behalf of the entire board, I thank you for listening. New World Notes is produced at WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. For the Scahill Talk, many thanks to the Unwelcome Guests Collective. New World Notes is available off the air by internet stream, podcast, or MP3 download at your convenience. There's also a weekly newsletter and a blog. All is free. For more information, start at the blog. We're at http://newworldnotes.blogspot.com. To receive the newsletter or to comment on the show, please email a note to Kay Doust. That's kdoust@hotmail.com. The opinions expressed in this program are mine alone and are not necessarily shared by anyone within 20 miles of this station. And they are protected by the First, Second, and what's left of the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. From darkest New England, this is Kenneth Doust, reminding you that you are not alone, wishing you a good week, and advising, illegitimi non carborundum, and please keep the faith.